All right, it is time now to introduce our speaker for the morning. Again, my name is Tarek. I am an addict, and it is my pleasure to introduce this gentleman. He and I were introduced to each other as a part of our sponsor starting a meeting like this at the beginning of the pandemic. I think it was May or June of 2020. And we were on this call on Thursday nights. And I've gotten to know my extended sponsor family as a result of it. And then, of course, about 15 months ago, I was inspired to put together a similar meeting for all the guys that I sponsor and their sponsees and grand sponsees and on down the line. And we've had a wonderful time. This gentleman is always someone that causes me to become present and engage. I love listening to him. He is articulate, and there is a sincerity about him that is it's very attractive. You know, I love listening to this man, and he's tender and gentle, but has a message of depth and weight. And with that, I give you this morning's speaker, Rico. And Rico, you've got 45 minutes, 50 minutes. You can talk about a step, current experience, your story. It is your time. Do whatever you like with it, my friend.
I'm trying to find the guy you were talking about. Good evening, family, friends. Welcome, newcomers. My name is Rico Cruz, and I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic. Powerless over cocaine, obviously. Mike, happy birthday, man. Thank you for staying, man. A lot of stuff happens while we're here, but I really appreciate men like you who just stay and walk through it. This looks like a great group. You got great support. Don't go nowhere because we need you, man. And if they don't, I do. I like to see men walking through stuff. And that's beautiful, man. 14 years, no joke, especially one day at a time. So thank you for staying, man. Happy birthday. I'll tell you a little bit about me, but it's not so much about me like I thought it used to be. It's really about what happened to me after I met you. I'm born and raised in Spanish Harlem in New York. And I come from a very, very poor Puerto Rican family. We didn't have things and stuff when I grew up. All we had was each other. And I remember back when I was going to school, my grandmother was my security blanket. I always liked being around my grandmother. She was kind and loving and compassionate. And when you went outside in the streets in Spanish Harlem, you didn't find that. So I used to like to stay with my grandmother. And it was time to go to school. I was a little pipsqueak kid, maybe 5 years old, 6 years old. And we walk into this bus stop. It was only about a block and a half, 2 blocks long. And it was the longest walk in my entire life. And we get to the bus stop and the guy opens the bus and I look back at my grandmother with those little puppy eyes, hoping she'd say, come on, papi, come on back. But she didn't, she just waved me on. And the guy opens the bus and I get on the bus and the door opens and all these kids are laughing and screaming and playing. And they had in their eyes what you had in your eyes when I met you. And that was that welcoming spirit. And I looked back at my grandmother, and I saw her wave me on, and I looked at them, and I gave them the look. And the look was, I don't want to know you. I don't want to play with you. Don't bother me. I will hurt you. And they accommodated me. They left me alone. Went and found me a seat in the back of the bus where there was a window, and I looked out of that window for the entire ride. We get to our destination, the door opens, these kids do the same thing, they go running and screaming and laughing into the schoolyard. I'm the last one off the bus, I go in the schoolyard, I find me a handball court, because with my back against the handball court, no one can come from behind me, and I'm watching out front. 5 years old. This one kid looks like he wants to come over and befriend me, but he takes another look and he changes his mind and walks away. And that was good for him. He had a good day. We go into the classroom. I look out the window the entire time. I don't even know what was going on there. All I could think about was getting back to my grandmother. That was my security blanket. Time to get back on the bus. Kids go laughing and screaming, jump on the bus. I got me a little seat by the window. Nobody, I haven't said a word. Nobody bothered me, and I just looked out the window. And why do I tell you this story? I tell you this story because from as long as I can remember, the fiber that has been the thread through my entire life was fear. And I was afraid of everything that moved. But I couldn't let you know that. So on the outside, I'm Billy Badass. On the inside, I'm afraid of everything that moves. The other reason I tell you this story is to show you the power of these 12-step fellowships, because what happened to me because of you, not because of me. I just happened to be there. You know, growing up in Spanish Harlem, I have five sisters and no brothers. When it's raining or snowing and you can't go outside and you live in the projects and it's poor, there's nothing to do. Each one of my sisters invite over 2.5 friends, and there's a whole lot of estrogen in my house. And when you're that age, you can't handle that. So I go to my default system. I look out the window. And when you look out the window in Spanish Harlem, this is what you see. Hoes, pimps, jackers, robbers, dope fiends, a couple of slicksters. That's all you see. And that's the life. I couldn't wait till I grew up to get into that life. We grow up. I didn't notice till I met you. We had a lot of love in the house because all we had was each other. We didn't have things and stuff. We used to make stuff up. We had each other, but I didn't know that until you guys told me about me. And I started listening to other people's stories. So I grew up with these five sisters. My job was to protect my sisters. That was a job my father gave me. And if I failed my job, he'd whip my butt. So I'd rather deal with the guys in the street than deal with him. So obviously I learned how to fight pretty early and pretty good, because most guys had one or two brothers. I had none, so it was just me. So I grow up, I'm kind of still a lot of fear in me, but nobody knows that because I'm always fighting. So they still think I'm Billy Badass, but I'm afraid of everything that moves. But I'm afraid that I don't get you before you get me, I might get hurt. And I wasn't planning on getting hurt. So I grow up like that. I go to school. I'm kind of average Joe guy in school. I go to junior high school. I find out I can play basketball fairly well. I get to high school and I find out I could play basketball real well. But what I don't want to do is, when I was young, except for my sisters, I was afraid of girls, afraid to talk to them, afraid to walk up to them, afraid to ask them for a dance. So I go to an all-boy school where all we do is play ball, study a little bit, very low, and not have to deal with those girls. When I was growing up, and one of them girls in junior high school, because there's a couple of girls that used to like me, and one of those girls would have ran up to me and picked up their dress, I'd have probably thrown rocks at them, because I had no idea what was going on, nor was I interested. I was just interested in playing ball and keeping moving. I get out of high school, and they give me a scholarship to go to the university. But I got to come up with a portion of that scholarship. But I told you, I come from a very poor family. We had nothing. We were lucky to eat sometime. So I couldn't come up with the money. And I asked them, would they hold it for me? My mother, who is the dearest person in my life, she was when she was alive. I didn't want to break her heart. She was heartbroken that they couldn't scrape up the money through the entire family to pay this other portion of this thing, just my books and to stay in the dormitory and the tuition, everything else would be paid for. Couldn't do that. We didn't have money. Everything we had went to feed seven people. So I didn't go. And I said, well, don't worry about it, Mom. I'm going to go to work for a year, save the money, because I was going to be the first one in my family to ever go to college. So I get into the world of work. In New York, when I was growing up, you had to dress like this, going to work. Didn't matter what you did. Unless you was in a warehouse, this is how you dressed. And I'm downtown with the guys with the real big dough. I'm the mail clerk, but I'm looking like the executive director. I'm dressing better than the boss. And a couple of years go by, I haven't done anything yet. Late bloomer. I meet this guy who we used to have lunch at the same place every day. We've seen each other. And one day he says, hey, man, I see you every day, man. I like the way you dress. Where you get your clothes at? We start talking and stuff. And he says, well, my name is Neville. And I introduce him to myself. He says, he's an executive accountant at one of these big advertising firms in Midtown Manhattan. And I said, okay, well, I'm just a Miraclerc here. So we eat every day. So he says one day, hey, I want to ask you something. I never see you with a beer or anything. He says, have you ever had a vodka martini? It's my first introduction. I said, nah, I'm an athlete, man. I don't drink. And this is before testing came out. Was no testing. He says, man, I want you to try this. I said, what's a vodka martini? So he calls the bartender over. He shows me what an extra dry vodka martini is. I said, that's cute. He says, here, try one. So he buys me one. I take a little sip. I said, man, this shit is nasty. How can you drink this? He said, just sip on it. Ice cold, just the olive in there, hardly no vermouth. So I take another little sip. I said, okay, it's not so bad. He said, go ahead and drink it. So I drink it down, burns a little bit, but it's okay. And he singles the bartender, bring him another one. So he brings me another one. I sip it down. I'm starting to tingle now. I'm starting to feel a little different. My arms getting longer, my shoes getting bigger. I'm wondering, what the hell's going on here? So I go in the bathroom to see if I'm still as tight as I was when I started. And I look in the mirror. I hadn't met you yet. So I didn't know about illusions and delusions and full flight from reality. I didn't know about none of that yet. And I look in the mirror and looking back at me is a 6'4", blonde hair, blue eye, fighter jet pilot, 2% body fat. Boom! I said, oh my God. I go back out. I should have known then something was wrong. I go back out and get me another vodka martini. I sip it down. I said, hold, keep my food warm. I'm not ready to eat yet. I sip it down. I go back in the restroom. I look in the mirror and that same blonde hair, blue eye, fighter jet pilot still looking back at me. From that day until I met you, I associate drinking with altering how I look, how I walk, how I talk. You know, the guy that's afraid of everybody is now Fred Astaire, Michael Jackson, I'm dancing, I'm macking. So I make it a way of life. The idea of going back to university just slowly just drifts away and keeps drifting and keeps drifting. So I start going out with my partners. We got a place in New York called the Palladium. And we go there on Thursdays and Sundays. And on Thursdays and Sunday, only music they play is salsa, live band, salsa. And I've been dancing since I was about 5 years old. My mother used to, they got a Spanish radio station. She put me on her feet and she'd dance around with me all day. I loved it. So we get to the clubs and stuff and I'm starting to club a little bit, drink a little bit, hit a little weed a little bit, hit a little bump a little bit. And I said, this ain't too bad. College is gone. I mean, I hadn't even thought about that because I'm starting to interact a little bit with girls other than my sister. We get in the club. They have like a place where you can go upstairs and look down. I'm looking down. I see Halle Berry, Cindy Crawford. I said, I think I'm going to take them home. So I'm in there. I didn't know about blackouts. So I take home Halle Berry and Cindy Crawford. And I wake up in the morning and I look over and I said, who the hell are you? I wake up with Lassie. I said, oh, how'd you get here? She said, you brought me here. I said, did we do anything last night? She said, no, you passed out. I say, you got to go. Now, if this was an isolated incident, I wouldn't even be telling you this. But it starts to become a pattern. I don't know about blackouts. I hadn't met you yet. Don't know nothing about it. So I'm going on. I forget. I'm supposed to be making some extra money, saving this money. So my mother asked me, how much have you saved yet? I said, oh, I got a little bit. So my grandfather owned a bar up in Harlem. You have Spanish Harlem here, where all the Boricuas live. Then you got Harlem up here, where all the brothers and sisters live. So he got this spot uptown. And I say, Poppy, I need to make some money, man. Can I clean up for you something? He says, okay, come on up. So I used to just wipe down the bars, clean the tables, sweep the floors, and that kind of stuff in the bar. But I got to tell you about this bar. In this bar, you could purchase anything from a pair of tennis shoes to a yacht. And you can have it delivered within 2 hours. So you know there were some other things going on in that bar besides serving alcohol. And that's the kind of spot my grandfather was in. So I used to watch this dude come in every day, dressed to the nines. He'd have an overcoat on, but never his arms in there, just hanging off, nice tap hat, dressed his ass off. And men who dress good, I used to watch him because I like to dress good. And I'd watch this guy come in, and when he came in, everybody would line up behind him like he was the Pied Piper, and they'd go in this room. And I used to wonder, I never saw him come out though. And I used to wonder what the hell is going on in that room. So one day I was over there cleaning that area, and I went to open that door just to take a peek to see, and I felt this hand come down to my hand and grab it hard. And it was my uncle. He says, "Papi, if I ever see you touch that door again, I'm gonna wipe you out." Now I knew what my uncle and them were into. I knew the life they were into. And I knew he meant it. I said, "You never have to worry about me again." I never asked, but I knew something was going on in that room. Later on, I found out part of my family was in the import-export business, but I was gonna be the first one to go to college. So they made sure they kept everything away from me. How are you gonna keep everything away from me? So I grow up, I'm in this social thing. This was way before rock came out. And found out the girls like powdered cocaine, Peruvian flake at its best. So I get a means to get some stuff, always keep it. They were like social food stamps. You know, you throw it down on the table, all the girls come around like ants. So that's the way we were partying back then. And it was all in fun. I mean, we even had cocaine etiquette. I mean, you can take a few lines, put it down, walk away, come back, still there, take another one, walk away, go dance and come back, still there. It was just, there was an etiquette to it then. That was way before rock and crystal meth. So once that came out, obviously, you know, all that went out the window. So we associate with dressing, having some grip in your pocket, having a lot, as much cocaine as you can, and some pretty women around. And we lived like that for years, having fun, just having fun. Now, I didn't know, I hadn't met you yet. I didn't know a damn thing about being in the grips of a progressive disease. So I'm drinking, tooting, drinking, having fun. Now I'm getting popular because I get my own little import-export business going, you know, on a small scale, but enough to keep me happy and everybody else happy and make a little money. So I start living like that for a while. Things are going okay, but I'm drinking more. I'm drinking more. As I continue going on, I'm drinking more. But social life is like off the chart. I mean, we just going everywhere, different towns, different places, just having fun. Playing ball went out the window too. Every once in a while, I go by the park and they throw me the ball and I take a jumper, but that wasn't my interest anymore. What was my interest now is girls, because I was always afraid of girls, at least talking to them and dancing with them. So I'm having fun. It's just part of the life now. We're going on with life. At 19, I have a son, never been married in my life. And that stops me in my tracks. Not right away. I said, damn, I don't want him to be like me. So I tell his mother, I don't want to get married. I'll do whatever I got to do. You take care of him for a couple of years. Let me finish my act here, and then I'll get me a spot, because I didn't want him around what I was doing nor the people I was doing it with. And we'll be okay. I whatever you need, you got it. So she agrees. I clean up my act. I get me another house. I keep me a little apartment up in Hollywood where I'm going to work out of. But where I'm going to bring my son? No. We're not messing around there. And I bring my son home. He comes to live with me, and I'm 19. So what you have is a kid raising a kid. Now I'm married. So I was more, when he was growing up, I was more like his brother than I was his father, because our ages were too close together. Hell, I was still green behind the ears. I knew the street life, but I didn't know anything about responsibility or accountability. But he brought that into my life. So he's growing up, he's going to school. I tell him, look, here's the deal. You got to be sharp. You got to be sharp. You got to read well, you got to write well, and you got to be able to do math well. And what those things do is they help your intellectual stuff gets sort of lined up so that whatever you want to be in life, you can become that if you're good in those areas. All he wanted to do was play football. I said, well, we're going to make a deal here. He's in junior high school now. He wanted me to train him because I was an athlete. I said, I'm going to train you, but homework first. That's the deal. So he committed to it. We got into it. I always kept me a hostage around. I mean, not a hostage, a girlfriend who would make sure his clothes were clean and he had something to eat. And whatever they needed, they had. So we lived like that for a while. Well, the time came that my son, this guy flew down from, was flying down from Utah to recruit him. So my son is happy. I mean, he's happy as all get out. This is the biggest day in this man child's life, 18 years old. So I'm getting ready to go to work. By that time, I was going to work, had a professional career. That was my front for what I was doing. But I had to, because of things and stuff, I had to look like I was a legitimate worker. So I got a job doing some stuff. And I'm going to work, and I hear these things coming down the stairs. Boom, 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 boom. It's my son running down the stairs. He said, Poppy, Poppy, it's Benedict. I said, what? He says, don't forget, the coach is coming down. He's going to be here at 1:30. I said, no problem. I'll be there. I said, I got no clients today. The only thing I have to do is we're going to exchange some Christmas gifts, and we're going to have a little sippy poo. We're going to say Merry Christmas, and I'll be back by 11:30. He says, okay, cool. He jumps up and gives me a kiss. I've been kissing my son on both cheeks since he was breathing. And he's a grown man now. And we still, when we see each other, kiss each other on the cheek. I come from a very huggy, kissy family. Don't matter if you're man, woman, child, don't matter. We all hug and kiss, no matter your gender. That's just how we are. And I was raised like that. So I go off to work. Every fiber of my being, this is my man. I'm going to work. I'm bragging about my son. I'm bragging. Oh, man, this coach is coming down from Utah. He's coming to recruit my son. I'm kicked back, bragging, sippy poo. Now, at my job, this is how we roll. This is Christmas time. Merry Christmas. Everybody puts in $1,000 in the pot because they want everybody to have what they want. And we have where we have our board meetings at. We have two gigantic tables. One table's full of booze, whatever kind of booze you want, it's on there because we ask in advance and somebody goes shopping. We got all the powder you want over here on this table. And there was a couple of cats like me who liked that. We used to call it tragic magic. It was China White. And we had that on another table. So everybody has what they want. Nobody bothering nobody. Nobody trying to get all they can while they're there. It's not that kind of party. It's whatever you want, it's here. So I go in there, we exchange gifts, have me a little sippy poo, little sniffy poo. Everything's going well. About 11 o'clock, the phone rings. My secretary says, Rico, your son's on the phone. I said, tell him I call him back. I call him back. 11:15, phone rings. All right, put him through. I said, Poppy, don't worry. I'm going to be here another 15 minutes and I'll be on my way. Okay, don't forget that. He's going to be here at 1:30. Don't forget. Well, to make a long story short, those calls keep coming. Calls keep coming. I did not know anything about the imaginary seatbelt. I didn't know anything about getting stuck. I didn't know anything about when you take the first one, you belong to it. It don't belong to you. I was always having fun with it. And I didn't know that the grips of that progressive disease had been steamrolling on me for a long time, only I didn't know it because I had things and stuff and people. And I think I'm just having fun, not knowing I'm committing suicide on an installment plan one day at a time. I'm not aware of that. I didn't know anything about that until I met you. So I tell him, okay, I'm coming. So I get my secretary to keep putting him off. She said, no, I'm not putting him off no more. Talk to your son. I said, all right, Bobby, I'm on my way. And I hang up. I don't get there till 8:30 at night. I walk in the house. You could hear a pin drop. I look at my, at that time, girlfriend, and she looks at me and she just looks down at the ground. Don't say a word. I look at my son. If eyes could kill, somebody else would be here with you this morning. He looked at me in a way that he's never looked at me in his life because I was his hero. I didn't want to be that. That's just who he made me. And I didn't know, and I'm still slow, I didn't know that alcohol and cocaine didn't give a damn about how much I loved my son, how much he meant to me, what kind of world I was setting up for. I didn't know alcohol and cocaine didn't give a damn about none of that. All they cared about was more. And I didn't submit. They just grabbed me that I was in the grips of that insanity. And I looked back at him, and they didn't let me respond appropriately, like with shame or guilt or remorse or incomprehensible demoralization. This is the biggest day in this man-child's life. He has been at the front of my world since he came to live with me. Only I don't know, I got no control over this. I haven't met you yet. But how alcohol and cocaine lets me respond is with rage and anger. And I said, if you ever, ever look at me like that again, I'm your father. And all of a sudden I want to be father of the week. I'm your father. I'm your father. You don't look at me like that. And if you do, I'll take your Puerto Rican ass out. And he knew I would. He used to hang with me sometimes. I said, I brought you in this world and I'll take you out. Don't you ever look at your father like, and I go in his father's aid. And he quietly just turns around and goes into his room and he closes the door ever so gently so I wouldn't even think that he slammed the door. And I go to the fridge like I always do, grab that pint of vodka, ice cold out there, twist the top, throw it down, and I forget all about it. See, I don't know that I'm driving a knife through this man-child's heart. I wasn't even aware of it. I didn't think it was a big thing. My girlfriend signed the papers, coach went off, had to go down to Fullerton, and business taken care of in my absence. I didn't know what kind of hole I had driven into this man's heart. Not until a couple of years later. My second wake-up call was my mother. Now, in my world, my mother is the most beautiful, well-dressed, compassionate, loving human being, short of none, except my grandmother. And she was very smart. My mother was my hero. I looked up to her. My father wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer. He was just an enforcer. But my mother, she was a lady. And I loved my mother. And I came home from work after that deal with my son, drop my briefcase. I go to work like this, drop my briefcase, take my jacket off. I'm headed to my freezer. And my mother stops me from going in the kitchen. And she says, I need to talk to you. So, okay, I'll be right back. I'm going to get me my after work cooler. And she says, no, wait. She grabs my arm. She said, I need to talk to you. I said, what's wrong, Mom? And she starts walking towards me. Now, everybody in Spanish Harlem knows you could call me anything you want. You could do anything you want, but you never get Enrico Cruz's grill. You never get there. Never. Everybody knows that. Or you're going to be in a prone position quick, fast, and in a hurry. Nobody. I earned that. Nobody walks to my grill. You can talk to me from a few feet away, but you can't invade my space. And my mother knows this. And my mother walks up to me. Her nose almost touches my nose. And I'm backing up, and she's coming towards me. And this is the woman I worship. And she says, you're getting high too much. I said, Ma, see those cars out there? You see this house? You see that duplex? You see this jewelry? You see these clothes? What? I pay for all this. And she's coming closer, and I'm backing up. And she finally gets right here. I could feel her breath on my lips. And she says, she pokes my chest. She says, I don't know who you are, mister, but my son died. And it felt as if somebody had taken a dagger and just kept digging into my heart deeper and deeper and deeper. Now, I didn't know cocaine and alcohol didn't give a damn about how much I loved to worship my mother. I didn't know that. I hadn't met you yet. And I said, Mom, you got to leave. I don't put no hands in her, but I talk to her like she's one of the girls on the corner. I never talked to my mother like that in life. But I didn't know alcohol didn't give a damn about that, nor the cocaine, or that China white. None of it. So, okay, I can live without you. I tell my mother to leave my house and don't come back. It took a couple of years for me to, I didn't know nothing about amends, but this, I mean, this lady, she was my go-to. And I'm talking to her like she's one of the girls on the corner. But I didn't know alcohol and drugs could do that when love is involved. They can do that when anything's involved. And my hostage, I mean, my girlfriend looks at me and goes, because she knows what my mother meant to me. So I got five sisters. They all live somewhere else in the world. I call each one of them up. You know what your mother said? By now I got the crying drunks. And then about after 1 minute, each one of them said the same thing. Are you loaded? I said, yeah, I'm loaded. I'm always loaded. What do they got to do with anything? They just all hung up on me. So I just sat there in my misery. A couple of weeks later, we get the call. The scholarship is approved. My son goes away to the university. First time in 18 years, almost 19, that I was free from responsibility and accountability. Because he kept me safe. He just didn't know it. Well, I'd have been off the deep end, but I knew I had to care for him until he could get on his own. That's what kept me straight, or semi-straight, I should say. And he went off to the university. I looked around in my house, nobody there. I pulled out the megaphone. I said, ladies and gentlemen, it is now party time. And within 3 years, I was helpless, homeless, godless, penniless, thoughtless, and I was walking around the streets of Los Angeles talking to myself. Went off the deep, deep, deep end. Had plenty cane, plenty money, plenty stuff. After 3 years, I didn't have anything to eat. Up for 4 or 5 days. I said, man, I got to get out of here. I can't let anybody see me like this. I still got just a little bit of that false pride left. So I go up to Nevada, from the pan into the fire, thinking, I can't let nobody see me like this. I got to go get myself together. And I go up there and I run into some Cubans and they front me and there I go. I'm off again. Until the last time. And the last time I met this girl with these green eyes that just mesmerized me. And I just kept going and kept going and kept going. And when everything was gone and she was gone, I said, this ain't cool. I know what's going to happen here. And I started roaming the streets, drinking, drugging, doing everything I could. At the end of my drinking and using career, I'm up in Nevada. I'm homeless, helpless. Looked like I had dreadlocks. I didn't have dreadlocks. I hadn't combed my hair in 3 years. I'm wearing baseball caps. It wasn't nothing dread about it. It was dreadful, but there wasn't dreadlocks. And I'm walking around town like this. And I'm wondering why when I'm walking down the street, why does everybody cross the street when I'm walking down the street? And one day I got a glimpse of me in a mirror. I was looking at these Jaguars in this car dealer. And I look in the mirror and I tried to cross the street. But obviously I came with me. The sight was terrible. Emotionally, spiritually, physically, I mean, I was emaciated. I didn't look like this. I didn't walk like this. I didn't talk like this. I didn't act like this. And I damn sure didn't smell like this. And then I started noticing everybody crosses the street when they see me. Why? I said, okay. So I decided that, you know what? Cheapest way to go is I'm just going to drink myself into oblivion. And one time I was on a run and I was up for about 4 or 5 days and I was like starving, mobbing. I've got to get something to eat. Up until that point for about a year or two, I've been eating out of dumpsters. And I don't know what happened, but something happened. I said, I'm not eating out of dumpsters nay another day. That's it. So I go to this place, this fast food restaurant. It's got up in the balcony upstairs. And at about 11 o'clock at night, this manager throws out the cleanest, dirtiest garbage. And with my rocket scientist mind, I'm going to hear that door open and I'm going to run out and catch the garbage before it hits that dumpster because I don't want to go into dumpster shopping no more. I had gotten to that point. I had been homeless for about 2-3 years. So I hear the door open. I'm standing in the corner like I'm pulling off a big deal. I hear that door open. I start walking slowly. I know in a couple of minutes he's going to throw it over. And I hear him toss that bag. And I run out. And I run and I run. And I'm going to catch that bag. And the bag busts in my arms. And my future goes down in the dumpster. And on my arms, I'm looking at these hot coffee grinds, these dirty scrambled eggs. all this stuff. And I had my first spiritual experience. And the spiritual experience looked like this. I had an out-of-body experience. And I was looking down at this animal, at this dumpster. And in about 30 seconds, I realized that animal was me. And I said, oh my God. And I, because of the life I've lived, which is a tumultuous journey, I've had pistol pulled on me 1,000 times in my mouth, cocked in every other place. You can put a gun cocked on me. Something somebody wanted from me, or wanted to try to take from me, or something I did, it didn't matter. But I'm still here. Nothing ever happened. I've never experienced, I told you fear was a fire that ran through my life. I've never experienced that depth of fear ever in my life that I had when I saw that animal at the dumpster. And I vowed to never put myself in a position to see that vision again. And I figured if I stayed loaded to oblivion, I would never have to see that again. And that's what I set out to do. I wasn't going to shoot myself. It's too messy. I was just going to smoke myself, shoot myself, not with a gun. I'm one of the guys that spent a lot of years out the gate by 8, in the spoon by noon, on the floor by 4, and back in the pen by 10. That's normal. That's normal. You get that gate money, we're gone. And I just couldn't take that vision. I thought I was Billy Badass, but seeing yourself as an animal at a dumpster, I couldn't do it. I said, man, something's wrong with this. So I just went running and screaming and crying. Had no idea where I was going. That's how much fear was instilled in me when I saw that vision. And I just kept going, and just decided to just stay loaded. I'm a die loaded. I'm a bona fide dope addict. I'm just, this is it. It ain't getting no better. I can't let my family see me because they can't see me like this. I was the exception to the family. Nobody could see me like this. I didn't want to see me like this. And one thing led to another until I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I just wanted to go somewhere and sit down and not get arrested. And this guy told me about this place in Pasadena, California. It was a homeless shelter where you could go and you could stay there for about a week. And I walked from downtown Los Angeles after I gave these brothers tried to take my last bit of dope and I had to give them a little baseball bat therapy. And after I finished with them, they hobbled out and said, I'm going home to get my gun. I said, I'll be right here. Billy Badass, I'll be right here. And after about an hour waiting on them, it dawned on me, why are you waiting for them? They're going to get a gun. You just finished giving them some baseball bat therapy. Maybe you should leave. And I walked to Pasadena, California, long way. And I just kept walking, but I was used to walking around town anyway, just kept walking. And I got into this homeless shelter. Now on this homeless shelter, I'm looking at all these people on the soup line, but I'm looking down my nose at them. I wonder, man, look at these people. And it took me about 10 minutes to realize I'm on the same line they are, trying to get the same thing they're getting, a bed, some hot water to wash my butt. And I finally got in there. And the guy said, you're alcoholic? I said, no, I'm dope fiend, bona fide dope fiend. He said, well, we only help alcoholics. So I'm a dope fiend. 3 times, he said, we only help alcoholics. And I finally caught on because I wasn't sharp like I used to be. I was out of it. I said, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I drink too. He said, that's all we help here. And I got in that homeless shelter and I got me a hot shower, clean clothes. I had nothing when I got there. And I didn't know when I got in there, I found out the next day that part of the deal, there's always a line to get a bed in that homeless shelter. Everybody wants your bed. People come and go every day. But if you want to keep your bed, there's 3 things you got to do. You got to go to this meeting at 7:30 in the morning where they read this funny little blue book that I had no idea what it's about. You had to go to this writer's workshop at 2:00 in the afternoon and do a writer's workshop, which I didn't mind because I like to write. And in the evening, you had to go to this thing called a participation meeting. What the hell would I want to go to a participation meeting and participate with you? I didn't want to participate with me. You think I want to participate with you? I just want to be left alone. He said, no, it don't work like that. So I wanted to be somewhere where I wouldn't get arrested for a few days and just relax. So I agreed to do what they wanted to do. So they go in the morning, they read this funny little blue book. I'd never seen it in my life, didn't know what it was. And I sit in the back on where they call death row and sit back there because you couldn't eat till the meeting was over. And I sit back there and go to sleep. And after about a week, something pulled me out of my sleep, out of a dead sleep, and I jumped up. I didn't know what it was then, but I know what it is now. And I woke up and I heard this lady mumbling, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." What the hell is this lady talking about? I go back to sleep. About a week later, I'm still there on overtime. I get woken up the same way, jumped it out of my sleep. And this guy's saying, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body." And I'm wondering, what are these crazy people talking about? And I go back to sleep. About a week later, I'm still there. Because my mother didn't raise no fools. I'm helping out in the homeless shelter. People are coming and going. I'm cleaning up, working in the kitchen, doing all kinds of stuff so I can keep that hot water on my butt. And this guy, who wound up being my first sponsor, he's taking a 4-year cake. I said, "Oh, that's cool." So everybody's talking in the meeting about how great he is and what he's done for them and how he's changed their lives. So I'm still an emotional cow. I'd rather fight than talk. And I wait till everybody leaves the meeting and he's getting ready to lock up. And I go up to him and I say, "Hey, Bill, what's it like having all these people feel that way about you?" And I'll never forget it. He turned around. He looked in my eye. You know how people look at the eye behind the eye, which is the window to the soul? And he looked at my soul. He said, "Why don't you stick around and find out, Rico?" And that just kept reverberating in my mind. "Why don't you stick around and find out?" I had no plans of sticking around. They sent me from there to a treatment center. I stayed at that treatment center. I went to leave. They hired me in that treatment center. And I worked at that treatment center for the next 30 years. Winding up being the administrator of 3 treatment centers. And I said, I didn't plan on this. I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I found out what that funny blue book they were reading was about. And I said, "Man, that's that book they were reading at that homeless shelter." These people came up to the treatment center because up in a rural area, and they take us to these business meetings. And I started learning about the fellowship one day at a time. I said, "Well, that's not too bad. Maybe, you know, something like that will happen for you." But by this time, I had become a no God baby. I would do anything, but don't bring the God thing here. When I was a young boy, I was studying to be an altar boy. And I'm dyslexic. So I couldn't learn Latin. At that time, the masses were in all Latin. I couldn't learn Latin fast enough. So these two priests thought the way to help me learn Latin fast enough was to one hold me and one beat my knuckles until they were black, blue, purple, and bleeding. And that would help me learn Latin fast enough. The last time they did that, wasn't the last time, it's the last time I put up with it. They did it one more time. And I said to myself, if this is what God is about, I could live without it. And I'd go home. My mother said, "Why are you going to stop fighting?" Because my knuckles were always bleeding. "When are you going to stop fighting all the time? When are you going to stop?" Because she was used to me fighting all the time. I didn't want to break her heart because my mother thought these priests walked on water. But they were beating everything out of me on my knuckles so I could learn Latin faster. Now, I'm sure they meant well, but my world, they weren't doing well. And I said, and I associated that with God. And from that day till I met you, that God thing was like, nah, I can live without it. And we had to go to church every Sunday. And all my sisters and I would be dressed up going to church, and they'd go into church. And I'd go across the street, there was a park, and play basketball. And when they came out, they'd come get me, and I'd come home. So I lived like that a while, hiding in the shadows, no God. So when I came to you, and you guys said, "No worry, God hands all this," I said, "Please, miss me with that." I used to stand in the treatment circles and pray, and all I'd be saying while everybody else was praying is, "Please let this hurry up and get over. I got to get out of here." I didn't want to pray. And after a while, nobody wanted to hold my hand. I said, "Don't pray around that guy. That guy's crazy." And I was. Every time somebody said God, all I seen was my knuckles bleeding. So I carried that with me for a long time. So I got involved a little bit. In those days, you could smoke in the meetings, drink coffee in the meetings. And I didn't have nowhere to go or nothing to do. So I used to stick around cleaning coffee cups, washing tables, whatever it would take at the club. And this old man said to me one time, I'll never forget him. He said, come here, Sonny. Now, I'm still a proud, arrogant Boricua. He said, my name ain't Sonny. Yo soy Boricua. My name is Rico Cruz. He said, sit down and shut up. I said, yes, sir. Because I knew he knew that I was dying. And I knew I was dying. And I sat down and listened to him. He said, I know who you are. You're the no God guy. He said, let me tell you something. There's something out there that makes that sunrise and that sunset. And that something's not you. That's all you need to know to start this. He says, and if you follow these instructions, something will happen for you. And I can't tell you what's going to happen. But I know if you take these 12 steps in the order that they're written in to the best of your ability, something will happen for you. He says, and if you run into anybody that's going to tell you what's going to happen to you after you take these steps, he said, I want you to do me a favor. I said, what? He said, run. He said, you have to have your own experience and find your own truth in these 12 steps. Don't let nobody tell you what's going to happen to you. Just take them. So he pulls down the book off the shelf and he opens it up. He skips the forwards and he takes me to the doctor's opinion. He said, let's take a look at here and see if this might work for you. So, okay, I got nowhere to go. And he introduces me to the doctor's opinion. And I start seeing what happened to me that allowed me to talk to my son and my mother like I did. I said, holy, you know what? Oh my God. I thought I was a rotten, low down, dirty son of a gun, an absent father, a no God baby. I'm sick. And he took me to it slow, word by word, line by line, paragraph by paragraph. He had a dictionary, a thesaurus, a big book dictionary, a marker, a pen, and a pencil. And slowly, I got to that doctor's opinion. I didn't feel better, but I didn't feel about myself the way I did before I got in there. And he takes me into Bill's story, and I take a look. I never wanted to be a lawyer, but I knew I thought like Bill. I drank and used like Bill. I felt like Bill. I said, and he only took me through the first 8 pages. Then he took me into, there is a solution. And I started thinking that maybe, just maybe, there's just a little ray of hope that I don't have to die like I have been living for the past 15, 20 years. No lightning bolts, just a little bit of hope. And then he takes me into more about alcoholism. Boom! Poster child. I see it. There I am. That's how my mind works. Oh my God, look at that. And while he's talking to me, I'm seeing little montages of my life that could be just taken out and put right into the area of more about alcoholism. And I start saying, oh, okay. So he starts talking about steps. Then he takes my no God baby self into Weed Gnostics and this Puerto Rican sleaze bag eating out of dumpsters, no God baby, falls in love with Weed Gnostics. It made sense, more sense to believe than not to believe. And he showed me why. And again, I get just a little teeny tiny bit of a ray of hope because I don't want to get too excited. And I told you, I've been most of my life out the gate by 8, in the spoon by noon, on the floor by 4, and back in the pen by 10, in and out burger. And I'm like, can't get too excited here. But I'm thinking, maybe something could happen for me. And this guy is telling me, this is treatable. This is treatable. And I start believing him because I see the way people respond to him. So we get to Weed Gnostics. I said, okay, maybe I'm gonna try this deal. I'm still a no God baby though. I'm not claiming anything. So we go through the steps. I got no problem with one. I've been to high school, college, university, graduate school. I mean, people who have an education like me don't wind up eating out of dumpsters. So I knew something was wrong. I knew I couldn't stay stopped. So I had no problem with that. I came to believe, breaks. No. All I see is my knuckles bleeding. He said, do you believe I believe? I said, absolutely. I know you believe. I see the way people relate to you. I see the way you look in people's eyes. I see the way when you're with that person, you're with that person and you don't get distracted. I know you believe. He said, well, then believe I believe. I said, I do believe you believe. He said, that's enough. He said, that'll be your starter kit. Believe that I believe. I said, okay, I'll take the starter kit. Then we get to step three. I'm like, whoa, Nelly, whoa. This is too much too fast. How am I going to turn my thinking and my acting over to something I can't see, feel, touch, smell, nothing? He says, take a look at this. You know you don't want to eat out of them dumpsters anymore. Absolutely. He said, then what do you got to lose? He said, obviously, you can't do this. So I just agreed with him, but I really wasn't in it. I got on my knees with him, held hands, did the third step prayer. But I just did it because he did it. Nothing happened for me. I just said it because he said it. I repeated after him. And for some strange reason, after we did that, I found myself writing inventory. I said, what the hell are you doing, Reed? I'm writing inventory. I didn't intend to do that. I got stuff that I'm taking to my grave with me. Hell no. In Spanish Harlem, the song is, no tell, no tell, no matter what, no tell. And I started writing that inventory. And I finished that inventory. And I said, wow, but am I going to share it with this thing and another human being? Absolutely not. And I wound up sharing this inventory with him. And no lightning bolts, but I felt just a little bit lighter, just a little lighter. What really happened, and I went home and I sat for an hour and I got into that, what was suggested, prayer, meditation, to see if I left everything off. I left something off. I called them up. I made another appointment and I went back and I told them everything. He says, okay, go back, sit down, see if you left anything else off. I didn't leave anything else off. Where two and three came alive for me was in six and seven. When it was, I finished that inventory and I shared, took that fifth and shared my inventory. Something happened to me in six. I knew I either had to come all the way in and sit all the way down or just go get me a little kit, couple of gallons of vodka, go sit in front of the mortuary and save the transportation people some time. I knew I couldn't pull this off by myself. And six and seven was a very emotional experience for me, deep emotional experience for me. And I remember crying and screaming out, I don't know if you're up there, I don't know who you are, but if you're up there, would you help me? I'm dying. Would you help me? And I was crying and snotting and wiping everything off, but I was screaming at whoever was up there. I said, you gotta help me, I'm dying. And that's when two and three came alive to me. And when I finished seven, I was off to the races. I wasn't even thinking anymore. I made that list. I knocked on those doors. I made those amends. And there was one amends that I was worried about. It was the girlfriend that was at my house that signed the papers for my son when I could never get there. I couldn't get there. And he got the scholarship and he went to school and he graduated and went to graduate school. He wanted to be like his dad. And I said, something's going on here. So I called her up. I did as my sponsor said. I made out my little 3x5 card. I had it written, the bullets written down so I wouldn't be talking out all 21 sides of my neck like I normally do, and just do this. And I made an appointment. She allowed me to come up there. I had to fly from Los Angeles to Sacramento, California. And she allowed me to come in and make those amends. I told her I was on a life and death mission. She let me come in. She said, I'm very happy for you. And I made the amends, all of them. So I thought. And when I finished, I could hear my sponsor in my ear saying, ask her, is there anything that I might have done unbeknownst to me that I don't know about? And I can still amend any harms caused that I'm not aware of, directly or indirectly. But what did I say that for? 2.5 hours later, I had to ask for some water because she let me have it. I mean, hot and heavy. She let me have it. And all I can hear is my sponsor in my ear saying, don't you say a word. Don't you say a word. Just sit there. Don't you say a word. And what happened, because I kept hearing that be vibrating in my ear, I looked at the harms really caused of the pain that I caused another human being because of my selfishness and self-centeredness. And it sunk in. And before she finished, I dropped my pen and I went to pick it up. And my Achilles heel came up. I saw those hairy legs one more time. Now, I'm still new. So I'm making amends, but in my mind, I'm saying, boy, sure it'd be nice to go back there in that bedroom and bounce off that ceiling one more time with her just for old time's sake. That's what my mind's saying. But that's not what my mouth is saying. My mouth is making these amends. And we finish, and she finishes. She gives me a little fish hug, not a real strong hug, little, I really don't want you to touch me hug. And I'm thinking, well, maybe there's something I could say that we can get back in that bedroom. I'm still new, you know, God, it wasn't finished for me yet. He just started. And she says, I'm so happy for your mother, because she knows my mom. And I'm so happy for your sisters. They finally got their only brother back. And I'm really happy for your son who got his real father back. She says, and I'm happy for you too. And then I'm starting to get some hope. She says, but I don't want to ever see your black Puerto Rican ass again in life. I said, what? And I'm saying to myself, after all these amends, she said, I don't want to ever see your black Puerto Rican ass again in life anywhere around me. And I said, oh man, I couldn't get to the door fast enough when she opened it. I got to my rental car. I dialed up my sponsor. I said, I don't say it now if there's any ladies here. I said, but you know what this B did? She said, he said, man, get in the car, get to the airport. It's only about a 57 minute ride. The plane couldn't get from Sacramento to Los Angeles fast enough. And this is before 9/11. So you could go to the airport at that time and meet your people. You can't do it now, but then you could. And he was standing there and I'm still flapping. He says, let's get something to eat. And we go to the restaurant and I'm going down. I'm letting them have it. And he says, you finished now? I said, yeah. And he looks me in the eye. This is the same guy that looked me in the eye when I asked him, what does that feel like? And he said, why don't you stick around and find out? And he looks me in that same eye, the eye behind the eye, the window to the soul. And he says, Rico, now you know what step nine is about. It's not about her. It's about you cleaning up the wreckage of your past. And from that day to this, I fully understand what step nine is about and why it is where it is in the 12-step order. And at the end of nine, you guys tell me we have now entered the world of the spirit. I'm looking at this Puerto Rican sleaze baby now, this dumpster. I said, when did that happen? I don't remember that. What is this entered the world of the spirit? I'm not entering the world of the spirit. He said, shut up and sit down. He said, now we're going to move into effectiveness and understanding. It's going to be our focus. I said, I haven't been effective in understanding in 20 years. He said, we're going to be now. He said, but you're not going to be running the show. Somebody else is. The God idea. And we move to 10. And I start saying, wow, the spirit starts to flow through me. Not overnight. I was one of those overtime guys. And this sleaze bag falls in love with step 11. So through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand God. And prayer and meditation has been one of my deepest foundational loves from that day to this. I absolutely love it. And each year, each time, I've been doing it for a couple of summers now, it just gets deeper and deeper. And I'm like, I'm always in a wild stage. Always in a wild stage. And I realize this whole deal is about love. Not that love that men think in the bedroom and when you come out, something else happens, that agape love that I get to give. No longer have to receive. I only love you if you love me. There's no more conditions on that love anymore. Not because I'm some great guy, because I'm not, because that's the way you guys raised me. Your love and your compassion, the steps, the traditions, and the concepts are the only reason I'm even here. And I'm real clear on that. And we move over into 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these first 11 steps that I took. I stayed there for a while. Forget about carrying the message. Anybody can carry the message. I spent most of my life carrying the mess. But carry this message. This message as outlined in the first 103 pages of that big book. Carry this message. That I would be concerned, finally, for someone else other than me. And as my sponsor says, shrink Rico, grow God. And over time, I assure you, it wasn't overnight. I'm a no God baby. Over time, that has happened. Now, I'm no guru. I don't walk on water. But I know I can put love on the table because you put it on the table when you met me, when I didn't even want to come near me. And one day at a time, my life has changed. The only thing I did was I kept coming back. It was the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the tradition steps, concepts, your love, your compassion, I'm here, and the God you introduced me to, one day at a time. I look back and I look ahead and I'm going, wow, why didn't I get this earlier? But I couldn't hear. I couldn't hear. I didn't know that I didn't know. I didn't know this was not about not drinking and not using. That was the starter kit. The program was about much more than that. And I'm still getting full off the program. I'm still chasing people like Tarek. I can see now. I can feel him when he opens his mouth. Not because he's some great guy walking on water, because he's experienced the program of the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could tell. And Tarek ain't no show off. He tells his truth. And I was attracted to him the first time I met him. And I met a lot of people in the same meeting he's talking about on Thursday nights, all my sponsee brothers and sisters in a meeting like this. This is a great group here. I was listening to you guys introduce yourselves. I said, damn, maybe I better move to Alabama. Shit, they got some recovery going on here. I like this, but my life has changed. I like other people. I've been a loner all my life. I like being alone. But now you guys have changed me one day at a time. But not knowing you in the grips of a progressive disease while it's taking place is a dangerous place to be, at least for this guy. And I had no idea. And I'm a pretty sharp cat. And I didn't know how dumb I was because I couldn't see. And all this is in looking back experience. Because I didn't know all this was going on. You might have. I didn't. And you were patient enough to take me to one step at a time, one page at a time, one moment at a time. And for that, I am forever grateful. I love you guys. And I just met you. But that's what prayer and meditation has done for me. And I don't need you to love me back. In fact, I don't even need you to like me. But if I am to love that power that you introduced me to, I have to love you. And not love with the lip service, love with my actions. Not to prove it. But it's a package deal. It comes with it. Love is how I walk in gratitude. I can't just say at the podium, I'm grateful. If you watch my life one day at a time, you would know I was grateful because of what I do. Before, I was a taker. Now I ask for nothing, but I'm willing to give whatever it takes in any given situation, as long as it doesn't harm me or my family or my friends. Whatever it is, because without you, there is no me. I'm real clear on that. I'm not trying to do this deal without you. And I've been on the other side of the continuum. I like the no God guys. I like the guys who are taught from the floor up. That's me. And you guys stuck your hand out to me. I had to stick mine out to you. So if no one told you today that they love you, I love you. And I got a God that you guys introduced you to and loves you even more, man. So thank you for letting me be here with you. I really appreciate you. And stick with Tarek, because I'm going to stick with Tarek. Thank you for letting me share. Hopefully I didn't go over. Probably way over.